The Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division meeting will come to order Wednesday, March 18th. The first item on our agenda today is House File 1756, Representative Cass has a bill about the Public Facilities Authority and the use, federal use of funds allocated by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. That sounds good. Welcome to the committee, Representative Cass.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. It is my honor to bring this bill before us here as we discuss an opportunity to provide some grants as well as expand the revolving loan fund that will allow for some public work within our communities here. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Terry Coleman from the Public Facilities Authority, who will kind of give a background on the bill itself.
Mr. Coleman, welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members, I do have a one-page kind of a quick summary of the bill. You'll see our PFA logo on top. If you have that,
we do have it.
The bill really does two things, and I'll summarize those real quickly. One is a permanent change in that we want to expand the loan terms to 30 years on projects that are for disadvantaged communities. EPA allows this. Federal law says the maximum loan term is 20 years. EPA allows us to purchase securities for investment purposes out to 30 years, and may want to limit it to disadvantaged communities. So we define that as community sewer rates over 1.4% of median household income. Spread those terms out, hopefully. That could have a pretty significant impact on the monthly cost for households when the costs start getting in high range. That's the first part of the bill in section one. And two as well, the drinking water program. And section three is where the stimulus funding language starts. And we do have an amendment that defines grants and principal forgiveness on both drinking water and clean water. And the reason for that amendment is EPA says if we use grants in our contracts, all the EPA grant sub-recipient grant conditions apply. If we use principal forgiveness, they don't. It's the same revolving loan fund requirements to comply. But it reduces a lot of the paperwork on the part of local recipients. And with that, otherwise, real quickly, the federal law allows us to use half the money we receive, the total grant amount, must be used for grants in the stimulus package. And yes, federal law also prohibits the use of revolving loan funds for making grants. So with the stimulus package, we need state law to allow us to use some of the funds as grants up to 50% or more of the funds for grants. It also requires 20% to be used for what people are calling green technology, but it's water conservation, energy conservation, water retention activities, innovative green technology, and a variety of things. So 20% of the total of the funds have to be targeted to those. And another reason for legislation to do that. And our intent, once this bill is passed, is to go out on a request for proposal for those types of projects to see what we have. And EPA is coming out with some guidance. We just had several conference calls or webcasts regarding that condition, and they'll be coming out with some guidance for local community governments to do that with it. It'll open the door for some more innovation and advancement technology, or at least cover the increased cost of the risk in bearing part of local community governments to undertake some of those things. Uncertain what the operation maintenance cost is all the time, and do some of those things. I expect things like stormwater treatment and cogeneration, capturing methane gas, using that to generate electricity or heat in the process, and a variety of things. Green rub funds on water treatment facilities, solar, wind energy, septic systems is something they consider a green technology, which is a very old way of treating wastewater, but from their perspective, it retains water and eventually puts it back into the groundwater. So those are all things that are going to come out as eligible activities for that 20% green. We are proposing, when it comes to green technology, a 25% grant. We're going to reserve those funds, and 25% of green technology to be a grant up to $2 million. And then the rest will be a loan. And it can be part of an overall wastewater project, or it can be a separate individual project that's being proposed. And with that, on the clean water side, the bill that you have in front of you proposes a 5% base grant to cover increased, we thought were increased costs related to more reporting that is required in the ARR Act. We have found that some of the requirements are going to cost considerably more money, as several communities are now in the bid stage. Helping to receive these funds and to build a Buy American provision is raising costs significantly. We had one in St. Peter in particular, $1.5 million well project, and that includes engineering costs and everything. And the metal pipe for the well casing piping, between foreign material and U.S. material, the increase was $164,000 because there's only one supplier in the U.S. that's got a corner on the market now. So what we're proposing is on both clean water and on the drinking water program is to raise that base grant 20%. The intent of legislation was very clear. They wanted these projects to use American-built products in their construction to make costs more, and that's one of the reasons Congress put 50% grant in there. They not only want construction jobs, they want the manufacturing jobs as well to create those materials. And another thing we're finding is it's going to take some considerable work on the part of the community to clarify things. Today's world economy, it's sometimes difficult to buy the materials built in the U.S. A couple of examples we've run across already are ultraviolet disinfection units. There's two manufacturers that build ultraviolet disinfection for wastewater treatment and drinking water. One is in Canada and one is in Germany. We had an engineering firm tell us that all the electronic computerized controls they use in wastewater treatment plants are really one company that builds the, integrates all the, computer engages and testing equipment into one unit, and that company is in Germany, the only supplier there is. So it's going to take some time to work through the Built by American provision, and we felt the 5% grant just doesn't cover it, and 20% should. There is a waiver provision in the Act. If that triggers cost of the total project to exceed 25%, then that requirement can be waived. So we're proposing that change.
Thank you. And I think all of you do have the 01, Madam Chair, I think all of you have the 01-07 amendment before you, which would put it in what Mr. Kuhlman had talked about, was that the grant includes principal forgiveness that is granted at the time a loan is made. This is some language that the EPA wants to have in there, and as the author, I'd like to see that put in here to put it in the language that we'd like to.
Representative Davis moves adoption of 0107 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
And as what was stated, there are two different sections that they're looking at changing the 5% and the 10%, Madam Chair, to 20% to be able to kind of meet with those anticipated costs that are going to be part of that Buy American provision. And that would be on line 3.18, where it says provided for 5%, that would be changed to 20%. And then on line 4.23, be provided for 20% rather than 10%.
Representative Hawes, move.
I do with honor.
On page 3, line 3.18, delete the word 5 and insert 20. And on page 4, line 4.23, delete the word 10 and insert 20. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, then we stand open for any questions.
Seeing none. Oh, Representative Virginia.
Yes, one quick one. We're all in tune with green technology. There is no sense of the list. It felt like a lot of them were energy conservation. But I was looking, are you hearing of those that actually give us cleaner water going into our lakes and streams? That's the first half of the question, and the second half, my part of the first half, are you getting suggestions from the Fish and Control Agency about independent production and preventing that as part of the technology?
Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, I should refer to TCA on that, but I won't at the moment. On the engine disruptor, I think we all agree that that's an area that's growing and concerning me to life. It's going to have to be dealt with eventually. Not quite there yet on commercializing the treatment for it on a standard basis or standards adopted, but it's something that's been raised at the national level as far as standards. That standards to be in place in the current administration on those regards. It was being discussed fairly significantly in a serious manner, which has been ignored through the years. When it comes to, is this green technology going to improve water quality? I think that is the intent of CCA's they're helping with the application process, how they're going to certify projects. Obviously, that is the goal of the fund. Energy conservation, if it reduces, pollutants, carbon prints, stuff like that's going to have some gains. It really needs to be tied into the treatment of water as well. Stormwater treatment, which has really been ignored from a funding standpoint, obviously everybody's looking forward to doing more of that with this fund. As far as projects ready to go, I think you're going to see more of that than some of the other more innovative advanced stuff because this money has to be committed quickly. However, with EPA's guidance, and this is a long answer, this clause is currently in the House Reauthorization Bill for the Clean Water Act, the 20% set aside for green technology, and it's intent to make that permanent. And from what I understand, it's something the administration in Washington also wants. So, from a long-term perspective, I think we'll see this growing in an area that does multiple things, but improves the amount of things that will improve not only water quality, but the innovation and technology that's needed.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, I forgot one thing. The very last paragraph on the in the bill, there is the drinking water program. There is a gap that the health department is concerned about, and it deals with the small, non-public community water systems like Girl Scout camps, Boy Scout camps, where they serve a transient population, and if their water is in non-compliance, there's never been a funding source that can address those. And, they came to us, and part of the money can be used for that, and we were proposing to use flat 50% grant to cover those. Not all that many, but there's a fairly significant amount of those. And just for the health, really get at really health and safety issues, they fill municipal wells and systems are monitored and enforced. Some of these just don't have the financial wherewithal, a lot more nonprofit organizations and things like that. This would help get those in compliance with the state grant. So that's the answer.
Very good. Seeing no other questions, Representative Eakin, you move the passage of 1766 as amended.
Madam Chair, I would move passage of House File 1756 as amended.
Okay. Any further discussion? Are we moving to finance? Mr. Coleman?
Yes, I believe finance is next.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative Taft. Mr. Coleman?
Thank you, Chair Murphy and committee.
Representative Huntley? Welcome back, Mr. Garcia.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you for inviting us back to Southern Minnesota. I left 3 feet of snow this morning in my front yard.
No.
That's hard to believe.
Not new snow.
Pardon?
Not new snow.
Not new snow.
No.
No.
Oh, good, because I didn't want
to stop. I'm glad to be out there with you again this week.
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, this is a bill that would apply some funds for the Duluth Children's Museum, which intends to move, and it's moving to a very interesting part of our community, which used to be an old industrial site, and I mean old. Like Dickens would have written about this place. You can see the manufacturing buildings, you can see the places where the horses used to haul stuff in and out. And so it's a part of it has been converted into a recreational center, which has two hockey rinks. And the Children's Museum of Duluth would like to purchase some of the property adjacent to that and move their facility. And I have Mr. Garcia from the Children's Museum of Duluth to make a presentation.
Just before that, Representative Hadley, do you know, you're asking for the federal, this money to come from the federal stimulus package also. Do you know which pocket of money, or
I do not know, but we do know that there is money available for projects that are ready to go, and this happens to be one that's ready to go.
And is this a matching project, Representative Hunley?
Yes.
Mr. Garcia, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
pleasure to be before you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record. Again, my name is Michael Garcia. I'm president and CEO of the Blue Children's Museum. And assuming we have technology up, and if we don't, I'm prepared to go to that.
Thank you, Senator. Just for waiting for the technology. Mr. Garcia, what time were you up on Monday night?
On Monday night, Madam
just
Chair...
Just after 10, right, Mr. Garcia?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I thank you very much for taking those members who traveled from what we like to call Greater Minnesota to testify on Monday in advance of those who were sitting here late into the night. I pulled into
just
my
home. Just after 10, Mr.
Just after
yeah.
10, Madam Chair. My arrival home was at 1:45 a.m.
Oh, just about when you were getting done.
Quite heavy. And I have great admiration for the committee. Just after 10.
Thank you. We have heard, we remember your original presentation when you asked for your base funding, and so we don't have to go back to that.
No, this presentation and the handouts before you are merely about the building project, and rather than struggle with technology, having witnessed that Monday, I'll just walk you through it quickly.
Thank you.
While they try and get it up. Basically, as Representative Huntley told you, the Clyde Park area of the west end of Duluth has been a blighted area in our community. When I spoke to you previously, I talked about the high level of low-income households in Duluth, and Lincoln Park is probably one of the areas most profoundly affected by that, by which I mean there is a high density of households with school-age children living in that neighborhood and area where we propose to relocate. The need to relocate the Duluth Children's Museum is not a whim or just a wish of me as an executive or of the Board of Trustees. In fact, 3 years ago, DSCW architects Rebecca Lewis, along with Rich Noble of A&L Property, conducted a programmatic and space use analysis of the museum. The result of that study was the determination that the museum would need between 25,000 and 30,000 square feet to serve the public interest of the expanding membership I've testified previously to you about. They reviewed the existing business model, personnel, and programs to come up with that conclusion. The board then appointed a site selection committee made up of two of the trustees of the board, Anthony Young, board chair today, and Barb Sayat, vice chair. They, with me, served on a committee for 2 years where we examined 8 properties in the city of Duluth and the surrounding area. Clyde Park emerged as the development most desirable for our location, and we explored with building developer Alessandro Giuliani 2 ideal sites. One was a new construction facility, and one was the adaptive reuse of 2907 Elm Street, which is on the front of Trove, directly adjacent to Clyde Park. There's a photograph and a slide of it with a yellow arrow that shows you exactly where 2907 is located. It directly affronts Highway 35 and is in fact part of the construction, reconstruction of Highway 35 that's going to take place over the next 2 years. The blighted area that Representative Huntley referred to are many of the old buildings that were not blighted on their building. In fact, the building that we will occupy was previously known as the Duluth Malt and Brewing Company. Interestingly enough, we just recruited Patty Cartier to serve on our board. She joined our board yesterday, and when she looked at this map and looked at the building, she was shocked and pleased to say, my grandfather built that building. He founded that company, Duluth. Proves that Duluth is a small community and what goes around comes around. The next slide just gives you a good sense of the building and its proximity to Highway 35. The older buildings have been replaced, as Representative Huntley has indicated, with the Heritage Sports Center, 2 hockey arenas, ice arenas that serve hockey and figure skating, as well as the Boys and Girls Club.
I'm a former restaurateur and a former hotel owner, among the other careers that I've had in my lifetime. And when we looked at 2907 Helm Street, there were three driving factors that led us to the determination that it was the right site for the Children's Museum. They all come down to location. Location, location, location. Any business person who founded a restaurant or a hotel will tell you that those are critical business factors that have to go into play. The I-35 frontage was essential to us. We've been located in the historic Union Depot in Duluth, where we occupy approximately 7,000 square feet today. And after 32 years of operation, we still do not have signage on the exterior of the building or on the freeway entrance that tells the public that the Duluth Children's Museum is located in that building. Highway 35 on this particular intersection, according to the data collected by MnDOT, has 42,000 cars daily, Monday through Friday, going in each direction. Now, if you're from Duluth, you'll understand why we can't tell you if that's north, south, or east, west, because we're driven by the lake, and we have a different sense of geography up there. But we'll develop a program at the Children's Museum that will help children use a compass so they can tell you better than I can. The Highway 27 freeway access directly connects to our frontage road into this property. It's less than two city blocks from our location. In addition to the Children's Museum, we will have the Heritage Sports Complex, the Boys and Girls New Service Club, the proposed new middle school for Duluth located near Wheeler Field, and a new hotel and hospitality center as part of this critical community revitalization. As I mentioned, this is in direct proximity to the Lincoln Park Elementary School that operates today and serves the interests of the families that we seek to serve desperately. It has the highest level of family density housing, as I mentioned, many of those households with low income, and it is just one block from the Salvation Army Community Service Center, a program partner of the Children's Museum. The building is actually in excellent physical shape. A structural analysis of the building was conducted by A&L Properties and by DSGW Architects in time for the Children's Museum to determine the adaptive reuse of this space. There's very little work to do in terms of the structure of the building. The rooftop is in excellent shape. We proposed to clay cap it and create it as a green, educational, replantable roof. You see the lower level of the building with John Erickson, who's an architect at DSGW, walking through the lower level, which we will fully renovate and occupy. I'm also very pleased and proud to announce today that John Erickson, a partner at DSGW, agreed to join our board of trustees and sat at our table with us yesterday at lunch. The last picture on the structural side shows you the cornice of the building and a little bit of the tuck pointing. It's been determined that the needs of the exterior of the building are very minimal except for that of cosmetic nature. The next slide says space use analysis, and it shows you what the Duluth Children's Museum proposes to do in terms of the adaptive reuse of an old building to bring modern aspects of architecture to it and to make it accessible to the public. One of the greatest operating challenges that we have today in the historic Union Depot is the Children's Museum is located on the lower two levels of that building. As such, we are unable to serve the interests of ECFE and the Duluth Public Schools because we don't qualify because of the access and our locations within that building. Our structural adaptation of this building will make it possible for us to serve ECFE, their families, and their children. The next three pages are just proposed layouts of floor plans drawn up by DSGW that show you the gallery and the increased space. We will basically triple the available public space of the Duluth Children's Museum. And the fourth slide of the layout shows you the rooftop garden along with the billboard that will market the Children's Museum. The rooftop garden will be a replantable garden, and it will be a joint science and education program with regional students. Construction timeline and cost estimates are included for you. As Representative Huntley said, this is a shovel-ready project. Kraus Anderson has donated their time to do his faith and cost analysis by trade and labor, and we've provided those figures as a general guideline for the project. The actual construction costs are roughly $4.2 million. That includes the building, the contractor requirements, overhead, profit, and contingency costs. The acquisition of the property is going to cost the museum approximately $725,000. The building is currently owned by Alessandro and Don Giuliani. It was appraised by F.I. Salter Realty, Sandy Hoff, at $885,000. The Giuliani family, who are proud supporters of the Children's Museum, have agreed to a purchase price reduction to $725,000, and they've entered into a one-year contract with the Children's Museum to ensure that the building is not sold to other interests, which will allow us time to secure financing to start the project. We have approximately $25,000 in interest if that runs an entire year. The total package cost includes pre-development costs of $175,000, pre-design architectural pre-design costs of approximately $55,000, the acquisition of the property which I've mentioned, FF&E or furniture, fixture, and equipment costs, architectural fees, and construction costs, bringing the total project cost to $6,090,861, and I did count that $1. Fine. The impact of this project is significant. The museum's presence and growth as a business contributes to the local economy by investing in local labor, both for the short and long term. Every dollar of the expansion of the Children's Museum will be reinvested in our state and in our community. The Duluth Children's Museum will provide another asset to this mixed-use revitalization project. And the Duluth Children's Museum is a sustainable entity, creating a business model that allows it to go into the future without the lack of business control that has threatened it over the last 20 years. As I shared with you the other evening before 10 p.m. when I left, children make up 30% of our society, but 100% of our future. The Children's Museum, in its first year of operation, using a 70% figure, estimates their attendance at 81,000 people. And I use the 81,000 people and 70% of our numeric study because I do not want to overpromise the building, but we really actually anticipate in the range of 110,000 to 120,000 based on research. The museum will provide educational programming to an additional 15,000 students, state and region-wide. Lamar Advertising, Outdoor Advertising of Duluth, Minnesota, recently put that billboard on top of the building that you see in the back of this presentation before the tab marked space analysis. And we're very proud that they're a proud sponsor and supporter of our public efforts. The tabs include the detail of what I'm presenting to you today, the space analysis, the construction costs, the timeline, the Gantt chart provided by Kraus Anderson. The case statement for the capital campaign the Children's Museum is embarked on, and most importantly of all, the financial projections for the Duluth Children's Museum are the last tab. Bud Colquitt, Leroy Colquitt, who's the general partner at Colquitt, Sykes & Goldman, served on the board of trustees of the Duluth Children's Museum in the 1960s when it occupied the former home of Diamond Will Chisholm on 2nd Street in Duluth, Minnesota. Mr. Colquitt persuaded a partner of his, James Christensen, to become involved with our board of trustees 7 years ago. Jim serves today as our treasurer, and Jim spent a year doing a comprehensive analysis of children's museums across the country in order to apply a matrix that shows the business projections for the Duluth Children's Museum in this site. He has devoted over 4,000 hours to analysis, research, and financial services for the Children's Museum to come to the conclusion that unequivocally, we know the Duluth Children's Museum located in this location will be there for centuries and generations as we go forward and serve the public. I thank you very much for your continued support, interest, and efforts to bring this to reality.
Thank you. I have questions. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I mean, this is an exciting project.
Thank you.
I wonder to what degree, I see that your financial statements are as of June 30th, 2008, and obviously the world has changed significantly. And I have a concern because I start reading your general financial statement. It says 6 years ago, the museum was in near financial disaster after operating with deficits for several years. You've got this new board with a lot of new energy.
Yep.
But is there a way that you can save this? I mean, this actually envisions an incredible ramp up of participation, admissions, and I just keep seeing these economic projections that just say we're going to be in a pretty slow economy for a while. So I'm just wondering what you built in as a cushion here to get this through. Mr. Garcia.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's an excellent question, and we have taken it into consideration. In fact, children's museums across the nation have shown a 38% growth in attendance since November. The Duluth Children's Museum has shown over 1,000% increase in membership and participation in the museum in the last 18 months. And the reason for that is people are staying closer to home, where things are less expensive and things are community assets that allow them to participate. The Duluth Children's Museum was at a critical point. It was facing the potential closure, which I've shared with this committee. And I'm very proud to say that Congressman James Oberstar, along with both of our state senators when we had two, authored an appropriation bill in the U.S. government. They authored it 3 years in a row, and as you all know, the federal government operated on continuing resolutions and did not pass the appropriations bill. Last week, I'm going to say, when the president signed the appropriation bill into law on Wednesday morning at 11 a.m. our time, the Duluth Children's Museum received $381,000 from the federal government in support of the critical educational services it provides. This federal support, while one-time support, did allow us to turn around the museum and its operation, get out of the negative position we were in, and go forward with confidence in the financial projections that you have before us. These financial projections have been reviewed by Jim Christensen since the economy turnaround, and our greatest challenge today and our need for this participation of funding is really on the limited availability of one-time capital expenses for relocation and the difficulty with that. However, we do have a private family foundation outside of the Duluth area that is committed to this project and has said with this support from the state and with local support, of which we have already identified just over $250,000, they will come forward and ensure the project reaches completion. I hope that answers the question.
Representative Nunez.
Public institutions doing building new buildings, we've talked to them about energy efficiency. And you mentioned a green roof, but when you talk about a building that you expect to be there for centuries, are you going to be super insulating it and putting in super good windows?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, excellent question again. We have been working with the Anderson Window Company, looking at the adaptive reuse of this building and at their energy efficient products, as well as other providers in the state of Minnesota, to look at how we can make this building most efficient. Our project architect is John Erickson, who is LEED certified, and our building manager is Kelly Davidson, who is also LEED certified. We will be applying for the first level of LEED certification and see how far beyond that we can go, which implies and requires that we do everything possible to use adaptive reuse of energy. What we are struggling with, however, is the reality of an old building and the adaptive reuse versus new construction, so we have to take all of that into consideration. We will be looking at, once we own the building, the installation of the wind reflectors on the roof, as well as solar panels on the roof, and the offset compressors associated with those. Those concerns are foremost to us because we want to establish them as an educational model, and we want to include an internal energy teaching component to the building.
Representative Rowley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to mention I've heard this presentation a couple times now, and I love these museums. I have three kids. Of course, they're growing now, but we've traveled quite a bit around the country and world going to museums and whatnot, but I just have a couple concerns. I'm a little concerned about actually your location in your city. Having spent a fair amount of time in Duluth, I would argue that you're better off having these sort of things downtown. Myself, I just think it would be a much better location because people can kind of do many different things, you know, walking, you know, and biking or whatever in the downtown and on the boardwalk, moving around. And then kind of going to that with the, I know you are gaining great visibility with 42,000 cars going by, but I'm a little concerned about when you look at the pictures, one of the goals that I know Chair Convenience is trying to do with many of the trails and things around the state, and, but this really isn't close to any, I mean, you said it's close to the people, but when you look at the overhead and the maps, I mean, they're the pictures. I mean, there's nothing really close. I mean, there's nothing, I mean, it's very industrial for blocks and blocks and blocks. So I just, and not that that can't change, you could do paths and trails and get that done. And then my final concern, I served on the city council for many years and dealt with Charles Anderson many times. And we had an old city hall and another old building, and they kept telling us, oh no, you can't renovate. You know, it's much cheaper and better to build new. And I would argue, I guess it took me a while to get to that point, but I think, you know, with using the money, I think you can actually do a better project with new sometimes. And looking at this, I have concerns, especially if you just look at ADA kind of issues, especially. And some of the things that Representative Union just brought up, some of the energy efficiencies of the future. I mean, you could really do some great modern things in a modern building. So I guess I would argue for a modern building, you know, with the old look or, you know, whatever you want to do with the character. So just some thoughts. I don't know. I think the ship is already left, if you will, using a Duluth analogy, but thank you.
Mr. Garcia.
Madam Chair, committee members, it's very exciting to have these questions, and I wish you could all serve on our board of directors because these are, in fact, kinds of struggles we've gone through over 3 years of site analysis. We looked at downtown Duluth, and we tried to find the adaptive use of existing space and attached other projects, and those opportunities did not pan out for us. However, what was exciting was when Clyde Park was proposed to be developed, we worked with the Hockey Association and the State Figure Skating Association to begin to map out the family traffic that would be traveling to Clyde Park over the next 5 years. And what we learned from those individuals is that in each vehicle, there is an average of three children, and only one child's going to get on the ice. And so we, as the fifth oldest children's museum in the country, began to look at what could we do that would take us beyond a passive experience to an active experience. This would be the first children's museum in the nation that is built in approximation to a fitness, health, and physical activity center. And so the Board of Trustees and the schools spent a great deal of time analyzing the opportunities that would provide to create an interactive and moving population. To that end, we're going to put entrances on both the front and the back of the building that abut the Heritage Sports Center and allow us to use joint parking. And I'm pleased, as it relates to the trails, to be able to tell you that the plans for the Munger Trail are to come up to this building and actually to terminate at the building. and to allow it to have that bike use. And that is now underway. Congressman Oberstar is very actively involved in that, as is the state of Minnesota and the Duluth Children's Museum, serving on the infrastructure committee. What we knew is that we live in a city where people want to be outside, and we want to encourage that. And the reality of the situation from a business perspective is that you have to be in a site. You are stronger financially if you're in a site that parents and families are using for multiple reasons, one that can attract both the local clientele and the tourist clientele coming to our city. The industrial area that it appears today is very much under regeneration at this moment, and is well on its way to addressing the issues of public access. Your concerns are not unwarranted, and I'm not making light of them at all, only to say that we have been down the path of all of those discussions with the belief that this building does work both in terms of layout, energy, and location.
Representative Lee?
Thank you.
This building is the ice building.
Mm-hmm.
And then attached to that is the Boys Club and Girls Club. And the study area for after school programs, also all in here. And then there's going to be a hotel, and over here is going to be like a picnic area kind of thing. It's a pretty phenomenal plan, and especially if the trail comes through there in 2000, whatever it'll be.
Madam Chair, thank you for those remarks, and adding to it, the Congressman rides his bike, and he's determined that on the grand opening, he will ride his bike up to the opening.
I believe he will.
And I bet Representative Hartley is going to be right by his side.
We've got a few bike up on here.
Representative Kahn.
I mean, once driven by the side of Congressman Oberstar on a bike, I would advise anyone intending to do it to start getting in the state right away. What I just wanted to say was I disagree with every word that Representative Lewin said. This plan is adopted to every meeting is the best way to go.
And I'm not going to be riding my bike that day.
We'll deal with that.
I don't want to come all sweaty.
I'm with the chair.
We'll welcome you all, Madam Chair.
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, I'll move House File 1290 to Finance. And just to verify with the author, fiscal staff suggested this needs to go to Representative Rukavina's committee. Is that sound about right to you?
That sounds right.
Okay, so with the recommendation for re-referral to the Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee.
Any further discussion? If not, all in favor of Representative Morgan's motion to pass House File 1290, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
House File 1556, Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
Ms. Winter,
Vice Chair. I think Representative Regina is going to move my amendment. I do have an amendment to my bill.
Representative Regina. For possible inclusion. Thank you. Representative Virginia's move the adoption of 1556 to be made over for possible inclusion in the omnibus committee account bill. And she moves amendment A1. Representative Bigham, do you want to explain amendment A1?
Sure. The A1 amendment, Madam Chair, clarifies that we are going with the governor's recommendation for the his budget request out of the general fund for the operation of the film board. For snow basis.
For what?
For snow basis, for the operation side of it. This just clarifies that it's for both years in 2010 and 2011.
And that's the operation fund for the agency, the film board, plus Snowbase, or just Snowbase by itself?
Just Snowbase.
Thank you. All in favor of the Virginia's Amendment A1, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the bill as amended, I have with me today the Executive Director of the Film Board, Linda Winter. House File 56, I'll let her explain in a second, is about it incorporates the Governor's recommendation from the General Fund for the program, for the snow bait program. And then in the second year, and I'm going to say this real slow, supplement the $4.5 million from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund for the fiscal year of ending in June 30th, 2011. So with that, I will let Lucinda Winter talk about the rest of the bill and just kind of what the program would go, the money would do for the program.
Representative Kahn.
I guess I should wait until after, but my basic question is, my understanding of this program is that one of the things that happens is that you bring in big film crews and you bring in big, you know, stars or just the whole production level of people in the putting a film together, and there's an enormous amount of taxes paid to the state. At some point, and maybe this is past nobody, at some point you look at this list of all the taxes that have been paid to the state, and then some portion of that just gets back to the film company. I don't understand. As far as I've heard, it was supposed to be self-paid, so I don't quite understand why this appropriation is needed, unless there's some mechanism of paying back that appropriation. So you get
receipts.
So all these taxes that we paid, and then, you know, a proportion of those
things. Right. Our program in Minnesota is
Winter.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, good morning. I'm Lucinda Winter, and I'll try to address Representative Kahn's question. Our program is not a tax credit, which would be that the production company is reimbursed, you know, they are allowed a tax credit for their expenditures here. Ours is a rebate program. So while it is very true that when studio features come here or TV shows are made here, commercials are made here, or independent films are made here, and they apply to our program and are accepted all the rules and are eligible for reimbursement, the money that we do track the taxes that those production companies pay to the state. Because in effect what we're showing is that for every dollar that our state invests in Snowbase, there is a return in terms of taxes collected, not only income taxes, whether the person working on the production is a Minnesota resident or not, during that production they're paying Minnesota income taxes. We also track sales taxes and unemployment insurance taxes. So we do know that there is a return to the state in terms of our state checking account. Money comes back in when money goes after, because money is being spent. But it's not a tax program, so it is not self-funding. We have to make that investment. In our program runs through Explore Minnesota Tourism. We have a grant to Explore Minnesota. When we make an investment in Snowbase as a rebate program, it allows us to, this is the kind of investment that about 38 states in the country are making, some tax credits, some rebates, depends on how their state sets it up. But It is not a self-funding program. We have elected to, as a state, to make that investment with the knowledge that it brings all kinds of dollars into our state. It provides professional opportunities for people in our state who work in this industry. It allows us to be competitive in other states. But it is a, we do make an investment, and there is a return on that investment, both in the money spent here and there is tax dollars that come in as a result of that employment.
Representative Collins.
Well, my problem with this is that the appropriation is coming from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. And unless we redirect it, the return is coming into the general fund. And so it seems to me, you know, Dan, I obviously don't know enough about this, but I wonder if we're continually being shown examples of films that we've lost and other states that
right.
have gone. And I wondered if all of them need, so there's two approaches to this. One, if all of them need these upfront rebates, from any of those very successful
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Khan, I'm sure Lucinda would be very happy to meet with you. The other person you may want to talk to is, of course, Chair Lunchetsky. I did. Didn't go so well with the tax credit.
Representative Bigum, I think Representative Khan is talking about several incarnations ago of what was talked about or what was done. I think at one time the Film Board program had a revolving fund, and over the years it's changed from time to time in, like I said, in various reincarnations. Now your proposal here is for from line 110 to 112 is for an additional amount of money to your base money that would come out of the Arts and Culture Fund from the constitutional amendment.
Correct.
And that's probably going to take some further discussion going on, because it's very possible from what we heard the other night that fund will be run by some type of competitive grant process. And so how does your bill 1556, how it comes out in the omnibus bill, it could have a totally different look to it. So let's not get too hung up on it, but let's make sure that we understand what the base funding is for and what direction you hope to get to, and what the, if you're asking for additional money in addition to what the governor is recommending from the base, then give us a review of what that money is intended.
Okay, and Madam Chair, that's what this one is going to do.
Right. And just so that we have this on the record, because it's really confusing with the, you know, all the programs that are out there. Snow Day originally ran in this state from 1997 through 2002 as a rebate. It started as a 5% rebate only for feature films. That was successful, so 2 years in, they added TV, national TV series. At that time, and they moved it to a 10% rebate. The reason, and it proved to be a very successful program for our state, it was defunded in 2003. Jesse Ventura, Governor Ventura, defunded it when he was red penciling a lot of things in our state to balance the budget. Version two of Snow Day, and at that time it was exactly as it is now. In fact, all we did was reappropriate for Snow Day in 06, the exact same program as had been existing, but we upped it, the ante again to 15% and then 15% and 20% with more money. It's always been a rebate program because that seemed to work very well for our state. The money never left the state coffers until all the expenditures had been and the jobs had been everybody then paid, and then the state would reimburse. So that's how the program has always existed. I'm here really to speak very specifically to some things that Representative Murphy, Chair Murphy, asked me to address so that the committee would be fully informed, because I do have both my operations budget appropriation in your committee and my snow day appropriation. So I'll speak very briefly about that. Currently, our operations budget, which is the money that we use every year to run our office, this is the money I have to match every year with private funds. Currently, we get $325,000 a year, and it really should be noted that that is $4,000 less than we received in fiscal year 99. So we're operating 10 years less with less money than we were in 99, and it requires us to raise, at a minimum, to take that money out of the checking account. We have to raise about $110,000 of private money on our own. So, and we have been successful in the last 3 years. We have been able to receive all of our state appropriations by generating the private funds. Representative Murphy, Chair Murphy, has asked me to outline what certain cuts would do. A 5% cut in our ops funding would do two things. We currently give out 2 scholarships to college senior filmmakers, not for their tuition, but to help them finish their senior film. Because we feel that this is a craft, you need to leave school with some sort of resume on film, and we ask those monies specifically have to be devoted to finishing a film project. Those would go away at 5%, as would we would also have to reduce the investment we make every month in keeping in our website, because our website changes daily, and that costs money. We keep it very current. It's a major marketing tool. Any film commission that's really worth the money people invest in it at the state level has to, in this day and age, you have to have a great website. A 7% cut would result in complete loss of website investment. We would have a website, but I would have to let go of the person who I contract with as our web person, and that's where that's vitally important to us, I feel. A 10% cut in our ops funding would result in loss of 1 of 4 full-time positions. We would become a three-person office instead of a 4-person office. And I can tell you, because when I started my job in 05 as film commissioner, I started out alone in the office. So I knew all the phone calls that came in, I knew what the workload requirements were. And the difference between then in 2005 and now, where I've had an increase in funding in 2 years ago with 4 people, in terms of what we can do for the state, is very dramatic. I don't think that I need more than 4 people. 4 people seems to be, and 2 or 3, I have part-timers. That seems, we are able to get the job done with 4 people. It would be a bit more difficult with 3, as it would for any small office. Moving on to my second grant that's part of your appropriation package, the Film Production Jobs Program, we know it as Snowbase. We are in the governor's budget for this current biennium at $650,000 each year. We got a supplemental one-time appropriation last year, which has pushed that, and this is in your handout, to $2.5 million. All of that money this year will be spent by the end of the fiscal, will be reimbursed to production companies. The result of that has been the following. The result of our investment has been the following. We have 46 total certified projects. That's feature films, commercials. We don't have a documentary this year. We have several TV series. And what's also open to reimbursement would be music videos, internet programming. So we cover the gamut of what kinds of things people want to make in our state. We have created, with that money, 201 full-time equivalent jobs. As a result of our investment, $14.6 million will be spent by the companies that are in the Snowbait program, these 46 companies, in this 2-year biennium. So that's $14,600,000 in being spent in our state. 201 jobs being created in our state, and our investment is at the end of the, right now, so far we've invested 1.9, and of course we're going to spend our whole appropriation, which is 2.6. So we will not have any money left at the end of the fiscal year. We may be paying some out till the 30th of the end. We have 30 days, but basically we have used that money, and those are the results. And it should be noted that going forward, the governor's 553 is a 10% cut in Snowbase.
So between this year, this biennium, when our base is $650 per year, in the next 2 years, the base funding has been, it reflects 10% in snow base funding. And that was something we, you know, everybody was asked to tighten their belts, and that's what it was. What are the results of the snow base if the committee decided that we should get the $4.5 million that we're asking for in supplemental funds? And I've based these estimates on the current 2 years and what kind of results we've gotten. If we were to receive the extra money from the Heritage Committee, it would result in, depending on if these projects reimburse at 15% or 20%, their eligibility varies depending on the amount of money they're going to bring into the state. $28 million to $38 million would be spent in Minnesota as a direct result of those projects that are certified. It would create between, and this is not pie in the sky, this has been, I've done this mathematically, 600 to 800 full-time equivalent jobs. Increased opportunities for Minnesota filmmakers, crew, and talent to work in their state. And opportunities for all of us to share Minnesota culture and to promote our state in this particular art form. Because we are at the weird intersection of art and commerce. That's where our industry sits. We are in that weird, weird intersection of, if we're making art and it's the right brainers of our state who want to do this for a living, but it also results in money coming into our state, increased awareness of our state, and the opportunity to tell our stories and film. And I also, my last comment is on the last sheet of your handout is to respond to Chair Murphy's request to fantasize a bit. What if you had $5 million more? And my response to that is that the more money appropriated to snow base, the greater the opportunity for Minnesotans to tell their stories on film, because we provide incentive for them to do that. More money means more jobs, more economic activity in our communities, and greater ability to compete with other states for projects like Gran Torino. We're all familiar with that story now. We lost that film. New in Town, Juno. I personally took 5 years off my life when we did not get that film. It started here twice and then went to Vancouver. So I think that my friends at Shooting Minnesota have been very clear in telling you, the more money we invest in this program, the greater the return, and it's an immediate return. So that's, I'd love to take questions if anyone in the committee has questions. Madam Chair, just one.
Thank you, Ms. Winter. Representing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of the things regarding the investment for our arts and culture here is there. I believe it's MCCC that now has a film degree, where from the broad spectrum of what it is for film, they offer a degree. And also there's
MCC?
Minneapolis Community Technical College. That's MCCC, by the way. There also is a local law school that now has an entertainment law specialty. So, just for the quick closing comment is that we have a very creative and talented workforce here in Minnesota, and I mean, we have Oscar award winning writers, actors, directors that hone their craft here, and that's why I support the bill. And the other thing, in this economy we're trying to create jobs, and the numbers show that for $1.9 million invested, we get $11 million here for Minnesota.
Say that again, just say it.
For $1.9 million investment, we get $11 million here in Minnesota, back here in Minnesota, for our economy. And just remember, if we would get Brad Pitt to do one movie here at $20 million salary, that's a lot of income tax we would get.
Oh, Representative, they would never see no living with you.
You are correct, Madam Chair.
May I just make one remark? Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. To Carla's point about the colleges, and this is, you know, we do have close relationships with colleges that offer film production programs and cinema production programs. And it's interesting to note that, for example, Minnesota State University Moorhead, and one of our board members it works at that university, their film studies and production program is their one of their most popular degree programs. They have expanded that program because there are not enough seats in the classrooms for the students who want to work in that industry. And MCTC, Minneapolis Community and Technical College, has just created a partnership with Columbia College in Chicago, a very well-respected film school, so that students in Minnesota can receive, and this is what, their first four-year degree program. It's a two-year technical college, but there's such demand among their students for this degree that they've partnered with Columbia. They share professors, and this is the first year there will be a cinema division studies degree out of MCTC. So I think that sort of indicates the interest that young people are having in this as a career.
I am curious, on the 600 to 800 full-time employees, you said that that's not pie in the sky. You've done the math and kind of figured how that would work. Could you just give us a little background on where you got those or how you came to those numbers? And are they full-time jobs, as in, year out, they don't come and go with film jobs, they're permanent Minnesota jobs? And then what would be the timeline? How quickly would we see those jobs? At what point would we see possibly 600 to 800 jobs appear in Minnesota?
Sure. Thank you for the question. The full-time, what we have in the film industry, there, all jobs are temporary. Well, not, I shouldn't say that. Our television jobs, for example, the 7 TV series that we have here, those create jobs where somebody comes in, goes to the office every day, goes out in the field. They're the people that the crew they hire, those are part-time workers in the state sense, that they don't work 40 hours a week, 50 weeks a year. But there is a formula that we use that's been approved by the state for determining equivalency, and it has to do with how many, the way, what we require production companies to do is tell us how many hours, the number, do a formula so that we know how many hours everyone who they are claiming on their snowbank forms as an employee or that they paid, how many hours total that they work. We put this through a formula that shoots out the other end what that number of hours accrued balances out to in terms of a full-time job, and we use full-time jobs the same way, the same number of hours a year, that if you or I were to say, well, I work full-time, it's X number of hours a year. So we have a formula that we use to determine that. But the 600 to 800 jobs, that would be over the life of the, so basically, what I did was I took the 2 years that I have to look at now, which was 200 jobs. And I did it, we multiplied the hours out and figured out that over the, so this would be over a 2 year period, I guess, to answer your question.
Yes, Tim Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, Ms. Leonard, I think you're mistaken in your budget getting cut in the first place. Was that you didn't offer Jesse Ventura a starring role in any of
Right. I didn't crystal ball that. Actually, that was before my time, but everything was getting redlined at that time. So that was a tough year.
Well, I've been, I think, generally supportive of what you're doing. I recognize the potential impact of data, and as I've said before, these movies that are written here by Minnesotans, about Minnesotans, and then go to other states or countries to be filmed, I mean, it just doesn't seem right. In New in Town, that sure didn't look like New Orleans.
Absolutely.
And so, since this does have the potential of bringing jobs into the state and money into the state, I think that, hopefully we can invest more in this to generate more investment in Minnesota. But I've looked at in the past at different programs that come to Minnesota. I think it's the 2006 list, the list of the commercials that were made here. Do you have anything similar to that in the last couple of
years?
Yes,
in fact, Representative Erdahl, member, did ask you, I think you or your LA asked that question before, and I did hand in a list to Carrie. And so if you would like, I can send it to you directly, but we did respond to your request and hand in a list of current, everybody currently who's in the hopper.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I appreciate receiving that. I guess I was thinking of the whole group, the whole committee, is what I was getting at, to get to. So,
Thank you. Ms. Winter, did the film board work with the film on Indian boarding houses?
Yes, we did.
North?
That was called Older Than America.
Yes.
Yes. And they were a Snowbait, that production was a Snowbait recipient.
They took my sign and represented Hilti's sign, but then when it was on, we didn't see our sign.
Well, you mean they shot you and then you ended up on the cutting room floor?
That's
the first time that happened.
And I had such an awesome right because they needed that touch of yellow, but it didn't come through. I was so disappointed. But the young woman that worked at Lake Superior College, that was a graduate of Lake Superior College that worked on it, sure did get inspired by her experience.
And I think that's part of why we do believe, Madam Chair and members of the committee, although that it's not a stretch, honestly, for us to be asking for supplemental funds, because even we are at that weird intersection of art and culture, but I do believe that we have a lot of stories to tell here, and that this is part of our cultural, I mean, what we do is very much in line with the purpose of the amendment, and I honestly do not, I do believe that we do fit into the Cultural Heritage Fund. I think we fit.
And Representative Lagunias removes her motion on adoption of the House File 1556. Is recommended to be considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus 1231. Representative Khan.
Just one more comment. I strongly support this. I think that this has a very sound commercial base. I think the comparison of other states is really relevant. But I hope in looking, obviously not every small grant state, but in looking at something of this size, that there would be concern about money going out of this fund when there is a determined return, and that return going into the general fund and not back into the fund
mm-hmm.
to do that. And
mm-hmm.
I also think there are some of us who have other, I don't know whose job this is to do it, but the taxpayers' opposition to tax credit, particularly when you have a stream of payback that's so clear as this, is something I think that might need to be approached at a higher level.
Madam Chair, just to respond to that.
Representative Khan, first, I think it will be a matter of discussion for this committee as a whole, and then recommendations to be made, and then probably at the caucus level too. And we have time to do that. And so let's go forth. We have one more bill we have to get out today. Representative Lagunias' motion is on the table, or is before us. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative Bingham. Thank you, Ms. Winter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Representative Eakin. Representative Eakin, House File 1070.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Davis has said he would be glad to have his bills put in your file to save, and we will do them at a later time.
Thank you, Representative Davis, as well. Madam Chair and members, I would like to move House File 1070. You recommended the pass, be laid over for consideration in the omnibus bill. And with that, this bill appropriates money from the Clean Water Fund for the purposes of investing in the River Watch program, which is a citizen monitoring program involving students from numerous schools. There's actually 28 schools that are currently involved, 200 kids, students who are currently involved, and analyzing and reporting on the condition of rivers and streams in the watersheds that the schools are located in. They monitor these rivers and streams and develop a greater understanding about the impact of activities in the watershed on both the quality and the quantity of the water. It develops a greater understanding of the significance of the watershed with these students. And it helps to meet the monitoring needs of the Red River Watershed Districts and the state agencies that are involved with these activities. The Clean Water Act of 2007 actually promotes maximizing the use of citizen monitoring in the implementation of goals and objectives in the Clean Water Act, and River Watch does this. It is a citizen monitoring effort. This program has demonstrated better performance among the students in math and science. There is demonstrable proof that it has, I think, instilled a greater, not just a greater understanding of the watershed, but it's also developed a greater, interest in learning generally, and has spread into other areas of the curriculum. Critical thinking skills have been greatly enhanced as a result of this program. It provides a basis for knowledge and decision-making, and engages students also in the community at large. So I think it's been a very good program. We were actually hoping to have some students here that could have testified to this program. They are, however, involved actually today up in Crookston in the University of Minnesota campus up there in a forum on this very program. So they were unable to attend. But I do have with me today Mr. Dan Wilkins from the Sandhill River Watershed District from up by Fertile, Minnesota, and he's here to testify on this program, as well as Mr. Ron Harnack, and I'd like to turn it over to them.
Mr. Wilkins, welcome. Mr. Harnack, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I got a cold, and I haven't had the sickness for so many years, I can't remember, but it attacked me on the way down last night. But I apologize for that.
That's a bummer.
I tell you, I got a lot of paper up here, which I don't usually speak to. I kind of go over the heart. This particular program started in our watershed district 14 years ago when I was the manager, and the current administrator, Mr. Wayne Gokin, we needed some help in our watershed district, and we hired him to do a little clerical work. And he found out about this program someplace in the world and brought it to our district. And for $200 a month, we fired it up. And we got four schools in our district, which is all the schools in our district, and about a dozen kids the first year. I think that was 95. And at first, of course, it was, I didn't realize all the benefits that were coming out of it. And we were looking at that stage of getting some good data on our rivers and streams in our watershed district, and this would be a way to get it. We had none of it until that time. And so we got the program going, and of course, one of the big things we did in the beginning was try to, these aren't just kids going out, dipping a bucket in the water and coming up and say, well, I think it looks pretty clear. We've battled with the Pollution Control Agency in the early days and actually, you know, came up with standard operating procedures. This is as top quality data as you will get if you send somebody out there at $100,000 a year with the major lab behind them. So we've made that hurdle, and it's totally accepted by everyone. It's stored in the storage stuff, so it's quality data. It's really important for our watershed district, especially, and that wasn't around at that time much at all, the TMDL stuff that's all coming down the line and whatnot. So I guess we've got the longest running history anyway in the Red River Valley of data, which I'm very proud of. In those original years, I fought hard to promote it to the other watershed districts, which in the beginning was quite a battle. Anytime you're trying to get a 5-member, 7-member, 8-member watershed board to part with money, they're fairly conservative, but they pretty soon saw the light, and after they kind of made it over the hurdle, I haven't had to promote and push any at all anymore. It's just almost get out of the way and let it roll. And this program, I sold it to the Red River Water Management Board, which has been on for 30-some-odd years, and all the watershed districts up and down the valley have now saw the value in it and promote it heavily. As was mentioned, the program has grown to, you know, almost 30 schools and 300 kids. And I wish all of you could be at Kristen today and just see absolutely what they do. It's just awesome. I'm also, you know, because of my long tenure in the water world, I'm the past chairman of the Red River Basin Commission, which this map you see here, that's the area. We cover three states and the province. And we've been trying to break down the international boundaries, which I think in the water world we have. If you notice, there's a few dots over in North Dakota, and there's a few dots up in Manitoba. And every time and every chance I get when I'm at that organization, I promote. My goal, I think I was supposed to say that, but my goal is to take and have 1,000 kids in this thing, in that Red River Basin, in all those, in the three states in the province of Manitoba every year. And of course, it's about a 2-year time frame that they're in this, the way the program is running now. So, you know, 10 years from now, can you imagine the young kids that have been touched out there by this program? What I really found in the first group of our 12, I think there's three of those kids that are working in water things in the Red River Basin. One of them runs a water lab at UMC. And if we could get that kind of build-up in our youth for the future, we won't have near so much problem finding water board members and other folks that will, you know, be real interested in it. I mean, you spark it as a youth, you've got something for a long time. And I guess that's my goal, and that's why I love it so much. And I could talk for hours, but I know you don't have time for all that. So.
Mr. Harnett, you've got half a minute.
Madam Chair, the specifics of our proposal does appropriate money from the Clean Water Fund. The citizen monitoring component, it is one of the recommendations that is found from the Clean Water Council. It is not replacing any existing money. This will enhance the program in the Red River Valley to expand it to more schools, and we hope over the next 3 years to have it integrated into the rest of the schools. We've had communication with the Commissioner of Education. We feel it's important for them to be a participant in it, and working with their STEM folks with the idea that ultimately this can be integrated into the formal curriculum of the schools as we move forward. If there's any questions, Madam Chair, we'd be happy to try to answer those questions.
That's good. How come we're just concerned about the watching the river in the Red River rather than the St. Louis River, where the kids have done such a fantastic job?
Madam Chair, we're hoping, one of the ideas that we have here is that if we can show through this effort over the next 2 to 3 years that it can be very efficiently integrated into the curriculum process, that it would be something that could be expanded statewide and be an integral part of BCA's monitoring, citizens monitoring program on a statewide basis.
Representative Eakin, you chose to come to this committee because, well, for several reasons, I'm sure, and I'm not going to talk about them, but, and you want the money out of the Clean Water Fund, but did you think maybe it should have a hearing in the Environment Committee, too? Have you talked about it in the Policy Committee?
We have not, Madam Chair, and Representative Wagenius. I don't know if you would like to see this bill. I have not spoken with Representative Wagenius about that.
Representative Wagenius?
Madam Chair, we are planning on sending you a group of bills together, and that hopefully would add up to the amount that you send to us.
I see.
And we are going to make recommendations to this committee. Just make recommendations, and when I said send the amount, I don't know what amount we're going to use at this point.
Because this committee hasn't talked about that yet. We haven't gotten that far yet.
But that's fine. We're not that far either. But we are hearing bills right now that would be eligible for this grouping of funds. So if you would like this included in that package, then perhaps you want to send it on or leave it here. I will tell the committee that last night we passed a proposed 25-year water plan onto this committee. It will arrive as soon arrive in time, but it has been passed on.
Good. I guess my question that I'm really asking is, can you talk about it among the package that you of ideas that you're talking about to recommend to this committee? Can you talk about what the content of 1070 without having the bill in your possession?
We'd be glad.
We'd be glad. And then so we can pass Representative Egan's motion as he made it, but with the idea that it can still be talked about in your committee before. Representative Virginia.
The protocol then, I think, and we're just straightening these things out, would be an informational hearing?
Yes. This would be a short one. Maybe Mr. Wilkin doesn't even have to come so far. But we like you.
Thank you, sir.
We're glad that you came here. So. Any other questions? If not, Representative Egan renews his motion for possible consideration of passage 1070 by this committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. There is one bill, and Representative Davis said I have to give a report to Representative Hausman tomorrow, I guess it is. And so we should hear this bill quickly, number 946.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would
one of our favorite things is in this bill.
I would move House File 946, and just so the committee knows, some of these items were actually passed last year, and I have to do a little more research to find out if it's the matching issues that they're concerned about. But this, if we can pass this through, we will be cutting that number back because I think some of these things have been done. The one item I do want to bring to your attention, to the committee's attention, is on line 1.15, a very fine project in the city of Chatfield that seemed to run into some opposition last year from my side of the aisle, and I'm back, and I will work on my side of the aisle. Your side of the aisle had the wisdom to see the value of this particular project, and I would like to move it forward and have that debate with my side of the aisle. So we'll have your people talk to my people, and we'll see what we can do.
Maybe we'll say to your people, or not.
I will probably pound on my people.
There's money appropriated for the Historical Society grants. And that's a very important project. And can you tell us a little bit about the what the grants would go for in Southwest Minnesota?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It'd be Southeast Minnesota.
Southeast Minnesota. I'm sorry.
And last year's bonding bill had an appropriation for the Holcomb City Hall building and the Houston County Historical Society located in Caledonia. And so I'm not quite sure why they're here, other than the fact that they're in section 138.0525 of statute, which has matching grants, and that may be the hang-up here. So I will do the research as this thing moves on, and I think the number will be less.
All right, thank you.
So I would move 946, be recommended pass to where?
Capital Finance and then to Capital Investment.
Capital Investment.
But I can report it to my... I can include it in my report tomorrow if we pass it today. So, further discussion. All in favor of adoption of 946 to Finance and then to Capital Investment, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, I would like to move the minutes of the previous meeting that ended just after 10. Of Monday, March 16, as printed.
Madam Chair, before we vote on that, are we positive that everyone's in here? I just want to be sure. Let me take a while to read this over. Renata's there. All right. We went from Isis from Isis to Renata.
Yep. That's right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. This meeting is adjourned.